Welcome to another edition of the Dementia Care Partner Talk Show. Now, here's dementia care expert Tipa Snow and your host, Greg Phelps.
Hello and welcome to Tipa Snow's Dementia Care Partners podcast. I'm your host, and joining me as usual is Tipa Snow. And somewhere in the glut of emails and topics I'm researching, I saw the words physical restraints. And coincidentally, I came across another article, which for all intents and purposes was talking about chemical restraints. Come on, is this still going on? And is this ever appropriate? And if so, under what circumstances? And what are some of the alternatives? Now, I've hit you with a bunch of questions. So maybe you can sort of tell me, where did that come to light? Is that popped up on my podcast? Yeah,
so there always been a historic pattern of physical restraint, which is where you keep a person from doing something by using your body, a device, straps, a seating system, a band across a seat belt. And if you think about it, a seat belt is a restraint. It keeps you from getting out of the chair. It keeps you from being shoved out of the chair. You know, people put on chest straps to do things like that. So that's one kind of restraint. And then a chemical restraint is a bit different, but both of them, and chemical restraints were things that we gave people with the purpose, and it has to be the purpose, with the purpose of keeping people from doing things, keeping people from. So the restraint, you know, the piece people sometimes forget is a chemical and physical restraint is to keep people from doing things. But this gets tricky then. So Greg, why do you wear a seatbelt?
For my own protection and for the protection of other people who might be in the car so that I don't bounce around and bounce into them.
Right. So it could be, in some terms, be considered a physical restraint because it's keeping you in that seat. So the determination was made a while back that the way we would determine whether or not it's typically used for a restraint is whether or not you can get it off if you want it off. So in seatbelts, they spend a lot of time on airplanes, at least, telling you how to get back out of it in case you want in, but get in it and stay in it.
In case you forgot,
In case you forgot, do this and then you can get out. So, but in facilities or in care, if the person can't undo something for themselves when they want to, and historically it's been on command. So I would have to say to you, hey, Greg, can you get off your seatbelt? And if you'd go, oh yeah, here, let me show you. Then it wasn't considered a restraint. It was considered a safety system. You know, it was helpful to you, an enabling device. So now over the time, we've done a number of things with people living with dementia, you know, and so we put pads in front of them. We put a table in front of them. We put, we tip their chair back. We'd put wrist restraints. We put chest restraints. We put a wedge in so that they couldn't get up over the wedge. We'd do all kinds of things and call it, rails. We put rails on the bed so they couldn't get out. I mean, and the reason people would use them is to keep people places or, you know, lock doors. So what it was determined is you can't just do that for convenience. So Greg, what does it mean for convenience?
Well, it means that I have a bunch of residents to get done. And it's so much easier if I can just sort of control them, because that way I can get the floors mopped and I can do all these other things and not have to worry about people getting in my way or bothering me. So there's all sorts of reasons I could justify it.
Yeah. So why don't, what's one value or purpose for them not getting hurt? What did we think for the longest time with restraints, physical restraints particularly?
Physical restraints. Yeah, I think we're trying to control their behavior and their movements. We want them in a certain place doing a certain thing at a certain time, and it's just more convenient to do it that way.
Well, but historically, it was all about the falls. We didn't want people to fall. We didn't want people to fall. We didn't want people to get into other people's rooms. We didn't want people, so we'd lock doors so they couldn't get in other people's doors. We'd lock the doors so they couldn't get out in a low. So we'd have all these safety ideas in our mind. But it turned out a lot of the time we were using them for convenience. And so there was this recognition, no, that's actually convenience. So it was made illegal to do it. But it's always this tricky thing. Like for some people, sitting in front of a table and doing things is going to keep them engaged, occupied, using their hands, using their eyes, but if they can't push the chair back to get up when they want to, it's considered a restraint. But at the same time, if they have foot movement that keeps their body moving because they want to move, but they also want to work on the tabletop, it gets a little tricky. And lately, people have come back to using a lot of chemical restraint because we're identifying more and more this symptom called agitation. And another one was repetitive asking of questions.
What time is it, Tipa? What time is it, Tipa?
It's 6 a.m., Greg. It's 6 a.m.
What time is it, Tipa?
Greg, it's 6 a.m. And so this whole, you know, getting tired of that. And so people find that when they give people anti-anxiety meds, they give them antipsychotics, they give them whatever, they quit doing that. And it was like, good. And we want to justify that to ourselves. And that's not my concern. It's like, that's on the rise again. I just saw a statistic that 20% of people in nursing homes are in Australia are getting medications that are antipsychotics or anti-anxiety drugs. And that's probably the case in the U.S. too. I think we veer more these days toward anti-anxiety than we do toward antipsychotics because you have to document more. So the tricky part is, well, but Greg needs it. And it's like, okay, what's he need it for? And this is where it's getting messy again, honestly, Greg, because, you know, people are saying, well, they're agitated. And it's like, you know, and it's a symptom of their dementia, their Alzheimer's. And it's like, well, is it? Have you really investigated it? And what people used to have to do is go through and identify, yeah, we've done this, we've tried this, we've trained staff, we've implemented this kind of program, and we're still seeing it. And we think it's coming in from internal, and there's no pain, we've investigated that. They're doing lots of things. And here's the tricky part. We don't think it's any of those. So we think it's just the dementia. And it's like that used to be required, and now there's less emphasis on that. And that to me is concerning for an anti-anxiety drug, particularly, or an antipsychotic for that matter. And it's back on the rise, I bet.
We don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, do we?
No.
Because, I mean, there may be, if we just do a blanket, none of this, no restraints, chemical or physical, that could be actually worse in some cases. So how do we balance that out? Do we have to have a team approach at each facility, or each care partner has to sort of justify why they may be resorting to this? How do we regulate it?
Yeah, I do think that we should have a pattern of, have you done this sort of looking at and investigating and skill building? And I think the biggest missing piece is often skill building and program development and environmental assessment. I mean, those are the three, and pain assessment. Those are the critical things I think folks don't check for. Is there unmet need? What is it? Are we trying to meet it? Are we even beginning to address it? What's making the person feel and do what they're doing? And are we trying to restrict them, or are we trying to promote and support them? So why aren't we helping them get up and move if they want to get up and move? Well, we don't have staffing. I hear you. So how can we work on the staffing, not getting people up to move? You know, and it seems like we put our focus in the wrong spot frequently. And it's often, well, let's keep them from. And that's where we need to really have programs that make a difference. And we don't. I mean, we say we do, but we honestly, it's getting tricky because of some of the things that people are opting to do, frankly.
You mentioned skills, and my mind suddenly went back to a video, and you'll know instantly which one this is. Mm-hmm. There was a woman who was going around dusting a couch, and that went on and on and on and on. So you managed to get in there and divert her attention to where she needed to be. Those types of skills would avoid a lot of the conflicts or the need for direct interventions other than what you did.
Yeah. And the tricky part is, you know, staff said, of course, this is where it gets tricky, because staff said, we've tried everything, nothing works. You want to try it. And so I asked some simple questions. And one of them was, what did she used to do for a living? And then what she was doing became really obvious to me to try something. And I was able to, number one, get her to pause when she got finished with the task. She couldn't figure out how to finish the task, which is partly due to her dementia. And then we took a break for a second, and then we walked to the restroom. She went to the restroom, and then she sat down and rested and got something to drink and eat. But it was only my skill that allowed that. And it's like, until we build skill into others in thinking that way, and it's thinking that way, not how do you get her to stop? The skill is, how do I figure out what's driving her behavior? All behavior has purpose. So what is she trying to do that I need to understand better so I can figure out how to transition it? Yeah.
Deepa, it would be nice if there were some easy answers, but I know that video is on the interweb somewhere. I can't remember the name of it, but I'm sure that people can search that and they'll find it. It's a fantastic viewing opportunity for people to watch and see. You make it look so simple, but you've obviously done it more than once.
I have. And I think it's understanding challenging situations or challenging behavior, because that's what folks call it. We tend to look at challenging situations, but I think it might be labeled challenging behavior because for many people, that's what they see. They see the behavior and they hear the challenge, but they see the person and not what's the whole situation. Yeah.
Deepa, thank you very much.
Thanks, Greg.
You've been listening to the Dementia Care Partners podcast. For more information on today's topic or any other questions, visit teepasnow.com.
Hi, I'm Teepa Snow, and you just found our YouTube channel and watched one of our videos. I'm the owner and founder of Positive Approach to Care. Thanks for watching. And if you liked, if you have a comment about, or you would, please share it with people you know. Ooh. And if you haven't yet done it, consider subscribing. We'll let you know when the next new video comes out. And you might want to visit our website, www.teepasnow.com, where you'll find other resources as well. See you there.